for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The White House recently proposed opening up new areas of the U.S. coastline for offshore drilling. It includes sections of the Gulf of Mexico, off the coast of Alaska, and in the Atlantic, where no drilling currently takes place. Here to talk with me about the debate over this issue, Michael Conathan of the Center for American Progress, Amy Harder of the Wall Street Journal, and Eric Melito of the American Petroleum Institute. Joining us by phone from Bedford, Pennsylvania, Jackie Savitz of Oceana. And throughout the hour, we'll welcome your calls, questions, comments. Join us by phone at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Thank you all for being with us.
Thanks,
Thank
Diane.
You. Thank you for having me.
Good to see you all. Michael Conathan, explain to us what the president has proposed and what new areas will be opened and others closed.
Sure. So the first and most important thing to understand about the proposal that the president released at the end of January is that it is a draft proposed program. So it's really the first step in a three-step process that will ultimately result in an offshore drilling plan for the years 2017 through 2022. And what's interesting about this plan in particular, and what's gotten a lot of attention, is that it proposes possibly opening areas off the South Atlantic coast and the Mid-Atlantic coast to drilling, where drilling has not occurred since really back in about the 1970s and 80s. It also proposes one or two additional lease sales off the North Slope of Alaska in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, where there are some existing leases, but no production has yet occurred. And interestingly, for the first time, the president chose to release this plan in conjunction with an executive order that places three new areas off limits in the Arctic Ocean as well, a couple of subsistence fishing and whaling areas, as well as a conservation area known as Hannah Shoal, critical for marine life.
Tell me how the Center for American Progress feels about these changes.
Well, again, because this is so early in the process, I think it's difficult to make a real proclamation because we're waiting to see how the process will play out. I will say that we are not in favor of opening new areas in the Atlantic. It does not seem that the risk is worth the reward there. And we have been very adamant that we should not be drilling in the Arctic Ocean either. It's simply too remote. It's too dangerous. And there is no capacity whatsoever to respond should anything occur in that region.
Amy Harder, what's so interesting here is this decision came on the heels of the president's proposal to close down parts of the Alaska wilderness to drilling. So how did the two parts come together?
Right. Well, there was a series of announcements from the White House and the administration more broadly that really kind of puts into context some of these announcements. Back in December, President Obama shut parts of all of Bristol Bay, Alaska. It's about 32 million acres of federal waters up there to offshore drilling. Permanently banned that, and then we come up to this most recent announcement at the end of January, and he designated as wilderness about 13 million acres of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Now, that technically requires congressional approval, which won't be so forthcoming from the Republican-controlled Congress. That said, since Obama has made this designation, it goes into a sort of de facto wilderness, and no oil and gas drilling will be allowed. And then a couple of days later after that, he opened up some parts of the Arctic Ocean. And so some people might call this political, others might call it balanced. I think it all really depends on what perspective you have.
Jackie Savitz, what is your reaction to the proposal?
Hi, Diane. It's so nice to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, we think the proposal still goes too far. As Michael said, there are some positives in the Arctic, for example, Hannah Scholl and the Beaufort and Chukchi, but the proposal still envisions offshore drilling in the Arctic and the Atlantic, which we agree with Center for American Progress is a really bad idea. We know it's a dirty and dangerous business, and besides being one of the fossil fuels that's contributing to climate change, it can also lead to major spills, as we saw in 2010. That can take human lives and upset ecosystems. And really, what we need to be doing is shifting away from these fossil fuels. We know we can't cut it out overnight, but we need to be making a shift away and toward clean energy, and one way to do that would be not to be drilling in these expanded areas.
And to you, Eric Melito, do you think the plan goes far enough? Is too balanced? How do you see it?
Well, we see it as being too restrictive at this point in the process. We're very early in the process, and we have to recognize that we're in an amazing time as a country. We are now an energy superpower. We're the world's largest producer of natural gas, and we're expected to soon become the world's largest producer of crude oil. And we expect there to be significant natural gas and crude oil deposits offshore. But for us to continue down this pathway toward energy security as well as national security, we have to explore in new areas where countries around the world are continuing to look for oil and gas deposits. And it's not just a domestic issue where we're seeing job creation and the price of the gas pump going down. It's a national security issue, because when the U.S. produces more oil and natural gas here, the world as a whole becomes less reliant on countries like Russia and Iran for energy.
It's interesting, Michael Conathan. Why has the Atlantic always been off limits?
Well, the economics of that region in particular, I think, are a major factor. The other one is the potential resources that are actually out there. And to the first point, you've really got an economy there, a coastal economy, that relies extremely heavily on tourism and on fisheries, commercial and recreational fisheries. And those are both industries that would be put dramatically at risk if drilling were to occur. And we've seen that in Florida as well. Florida has opposed opening new areas to drilling, both on the eastern Gulf of Mexico as well as Florida's Atlantic coast, precisely because of their tourism industry and because of the economic development that they have in that regard, which again relies on clean, healthy ocean ecosystems.
Interesting that the president proposed the same thing back in 2010. Amy, what happened then?
Right. Well, we should remember that in March 2010, President Obama himself gave this big speech about energy security, and he underscored the importance of developing our own oil resources so we can get off foreign oil. Well, let's fast forward to the present, and now we're producing all of this oil ourselves, mostly from onshore versus offshore. So in that March 2010 speech, he proposed in this early step to open up some parts of the Atlantic Ocean, similar to what the administration has just done today. But of course, a couple of months later, the BP oil spill occurred in the Gulf of Mexico. That really put everything on pause in terms of deep water drilling in the Gulf. And it also prompted the administration to retreat on its proposal to propose any leases in the Atlantic Ocean. And I would say that this plan, this is the most lease sales that it could ever offer. The plan can only get narrower as we get down to the final product. So while there is a proposed Atlantic Ocean lease sale right now, the final could very well not include it. And for a president that wants to cement an environmental climate change legacy, I could see him ultimately not including that in the final draft.
So, Eric, what has changed since 2010, since that first proposal, since the BP oil spill? Hasn't the availability of energy gone up around this country altogether?
Well, we certainly are, like I said, producing much greater quantities of oil and natural gas than we ever have before. But the offshore region is an area where this country has relied upon development of oil and gas to suit its energy needs for decades. It's been a contributor to the tune of 30% of our oil production in the past. It's about 17% now. And it's a key strategic asset that we have to look at. And as we move forward, we understand, based upon what analysts are suggesting, is that we could see production decline in a place like the Gulf of Mexico. And then you look in the rest of the Atlantic, you see major areas and fields of production off the coast of Nova Scotia, off the coast of Newfoundland and Labrador. And in these areas, we've seen coastal economies and seaports like St. John's completely revived. They were determined to be near extinct, and they were brought back from what experts refer to as comas because the energy industry came in and provided a balanced economy. So moving forward, we have to look into the future. We have to look 5, 10, 15 years from now, because the production we have in the Gulf of Mexico is because of decisions that were made 5, 10 years ago.
But now the question that Michael raised about tourism and the aquatic life, how do you respond?
Well, the Gulf of Mexico is a great example where the energy industry and the fishing, both commercial and recreational fishing industries, thrive together. Commercial and recreational fishing in the Gulf of Mexico, it's a $980 million per year business. It supports 120,000 workers throughout that and fishermen throughout that area. And we've seen people from all over the country go to that area to fish. They go to offshore rigs to get their bait and then go to deep water. So it's very compatible. And our proposal that we see includes a buffer of 50 miles where energy production would occur outside of that in the Atlantic.
Eric Melito, he's with the American Petroleum Institute. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Citrix with GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring HD video conferencing, screen sharing, and meeting recording capabilities. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. From the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school. More information is available at wallacefoundation.org.
Welcome back. We're talking about the president's announcement earlier this year to open up new areas off the U.S. coastline for drilling for oil and natural gas. Here with me, Michael Conathan, Director of Ocean Policy at the Center for American Progress. Amy Harder is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Eric Melito is Director of Upstream and Industry Operations for the American Petroleum Institute, and joining us by phone, Jackie Savitz. She's Vice President for U.S. Oceans at Oceana. Just before the break, Amy Harder, we were talking about tourism on some coasts and the growth of the fishing industry. You want to add something to that?
Right. It's interesting because I think part of the reason why the administration feels like they have the political room to propose offshore drilling off the Atlantic coast is because a lot of the lawmakers and the governors from Virginia down south to Georgia actually cautiously support drilling off the coast because of the economic benefits that it could bring the region. I think the support varies whether or not you're Democrat or Republican, but Senator Mark Warner, a Democrat from Virginia, for example, cautiously supports it. He and the other Democrat from Virginia, Tim Kaine, they want to have a cut of the revenue, and that's still something that's to be decided. But I think there is support for that. The Democrats north that would not get any economic drilling, now they do not support it because of the concerns about tourism and fishing. And
Jackie Savitz.
It's an interesting point Amy makes, and in fact, I think a little bit of what we're seeing is a disagreement between the coasts and the capital, and the capitals in some of these states, where we've seen in now 36 coastal towns, citizens coming out in opposition to offshore drilling and seismic exploration for oil, and actually passing resolutions in their towns opposing that activity, and that number is growing. It seems like every week we're seeing another one or two of these resolutions. We're seeing local papers editorializing 40 editorials we've counted against offshore drilling in those states, 225 state and local elected officials, 60 members of Congress, and plenty of conservation groups, of course, all coming out against it. But yet, in some of these states, governors still expressing an interest. And sometimes that interest is, as Amy said, is premised on this sort of concept that they're going to get money through what they call a revenue sharing process, a process that doesn't currently exist and, in fact, would have to be created by Congress. And it's been tried before and failed. So it's really not a done deal. It's not a sure thing. And so they're really being told that there's this money out there that may or may not really be there. In the meantime, the tourism economies and fisheries economies are all in the balance.
Here's an email from Stephen. The petroleum industry plans to fire sonic blasts into the water to map potential oil fields under the continental shelf of the East Coast. The U.S. Navy has been using low-frequency active sonar on a smaller scale. The repetitive high-energy blast that can persist for months will deafen and certainly lead to the death of all kinds of sea life, whales and turtles, for example, and could bring some species to extinction. Eric, how does the petroleum industry regard those concerns?
Well, we look to the government's conclusions on this. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management itself has stated, to date, there's been no documented scientific evidence of noise from air guns used in geological and geophysical seismic activities adversely affecting marine animal populations or coastal communities. This technology has been used for more than 30 years around the world. It is still used in waters off the Gulf of Mexico with no known detrimental impact to marine animal populations or to commercial fishing. This is scientific research that the government itself conducts.
Michael, do you want to comment?
Sure. I think there's certainly a lot of research out there, and perhaps Jackie can speak to this as well. I know Oceana has done quite a bit of research in this area, but I think it's absolutely a legitimate concern that there are clearly studies out there that show these sonic testing, this geophysical exploration does have severe detrimental effects, particularly on marine mammals and turtles, as the emailer suggested.
Jackie.
Yeah, we spoke to the Department of the Interior's chief scientist about that statement in this. I believe you're reading from the science notes there, Eric, and he actually backed away from it pretty quickly, which is a good thing because the department's own documents, official materials like their environmental impact studies, are estimating that seismic exploration could injure as many as 138,000 marine mammals, and some of them could be killed. They also say it could disrupt feeding, calving, breeding, and other activities of millions more animals. And you can imagine if in your neighborhood there was dynamite going off every 10 seconds for days or weeks on end, it'd be pretty hard to to do some of the normal things that we have to do. And, you know, if you depend on your hearing, as many of these marine mammals do,
sure.
to feed, mate, et cetera, it makes it hard for them to survive. And one other point I'll add is, you know, what we've seen as well is in fish that thousands of square kilometers away from where seismic air guns are used, there can be impacts on catch rates of species like cod, and even rockfish. So this is an impact not only to the marine animals, also to the fish and the fishermen themselves.
However, I am somewhat confused where you, Eric, read from that statement. Is that an official final statement? Or, as Jackie Savitt says, did the government back away from that statement?
I'm not aware that they backed away from the statement at all. In fact, if you look at the environmental impact statement, it suggests that the impacts to marine mammals would be negligible or minor. And when she talks about 138,000 expected injuries, what they're referring to is potential behavioral impacts where mammals could potentially move away, but that's without applying the mitigation measures that are required for these surveys. So surveys must mitigate their potential impacts to marines by having technologies and measures in place to make sure that they are putting forth efforts to avoid harm to mammals.
How can we know what kinds of mitigating effects would help to protect the animals?
Well, they're included in the environmental impact statement, and they're also included in the permits, where when you start a seismic survey, you actually slowly ramp up the sound. So mammals, if they're in the area, they have the opportunity to move away. You're required to have observers on board, so if you see mammals, you have to shut down and wait until the area is clear. And there are restricted areas where you cannot do seismic surveys.
On the other hand, how do you know about the long-term impact, Michael?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The populations are very difficult to monitor, although obviously with some of the key endangered species in the region, there are strong efforts to do just that and to keep tabs. You know, one of those species in particular, the critically endangered North Atlantic right whale, where scientists estimate that there are currently about 400 individuals remaining in that population. And there have been remarkable efforts put in place to protect these animals in other industries, particularly with the lobster industry in Maine, major gear changes to prevent entanglements, and the shipping industry along the East Coast, which had major restrictions on speed during the times when the right whales are migrating along this path. So, you know, allowing additional impacts to occur to these animals while these other industries are already bearing the brunt of rebuilding seems like a cumulative bad idea.
Amy, do we have any idea how much oil is out there?
Out in the outer continental shelf?
Right.
Well, there's various estimates of that. I know that most of the oil is in the Gulf of Mexico, and that's why it continually reflects where the administration offers leases. In this latest proposal, it was 10 in the Gulf of Mexico, 3 off the coast of Alaska, and just 1 off the East Coast. So that shows that that's where most of the oil is coming from. That said, in the last five or six years, the oil production has actually declined offshore, has dropped 18% since 2009 to 1.5 million barrels of oil a day, which is less than one-fifth of all of the U.S. oil production today, according to the U.S. government. And that's declining slightly, although I would say the government put out some new statements just today saying that it will increase slightly, given some new production fields coming online in the next couple of days. But generally speaking, the last 6 years has really have seen a sea change, no pun intended, to move the focus of the oil industry onshore. Of course, that's not to say the offshore is not the focus. It certainly is for the major international oil companies. But more and more, we're seeing oil and gas coming from onshore.
Jackie, do we really need the offshore drilling?
Absolutely not, Diane. We've done an analysis of how much energy we could get from offshore oil and offshore wind, and we came to the conclusion that the offshore oil that's out there in the Atlantic would only be meeting our demands for about 130 days, and gas for maybe 280 days. But even then, it's less than a year. And in comparison, if you look at the offshore wind that's out there, we think that offshore wind in the Atlantic could produce the equivalent of 5 billion barrels of oil, which is more than what's economically recoverable in that same area. Obviously, the oil is going to run out at some point, and wind won't. And so what we really should be doing is shifting our focus to the energy of the future rather than continuing to double down on the energy of the past.
Eric, what's your reaction to that? That wind could really produce far more than any regroup from offshore drilling.
Well, we need all the above, and wind is an energy source for electricity generation, and I think the proposal that Oceana's talking about would entail 100,000 wind turbines along the coastline that are 90 meters high. But that said, you know, we support an all-the-above approach, and the Department of Energy, through its Energy Information Administration, projects that our economy is going to increase its energy needs by 12% over the next 20 years, but we're still going to use 60% of oil and natural, 60% of our energy will still come from oil and natural gas resources to fuel this economy. And then we're also competing with a global economy, which is going to increase its demand by 50%. So we need all the energy we can get. Wind is a great source of energy. Wind is backed up by natural gas, which is something we expect to find in the offshore.
Amy.
I think it's also important to recall the difference between wind and oil. We use oil for our cars and transportation. Wind is primarily for electricity. And so in order to have electricity as a car source, you need a lot of other pieces of infrastructure. And wind, while there is a potential for a lot of resources, there are a lot of other economic problems facing wind. There are no offshore wind farms currently in the U.S. at all. The only one that the one that's furthest along in being proposed has been delayed for more than a decade up in Cape Cod. So there are a lot of other challenges facing wind at the moment.
All right. And let's take a call from Mike in Athens, Ohio. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to the conversation here. I haven't heard anybody mention the layer of methane hydrate that lines the perimeter of all the continents. They've done shows on this. It was actually drilling rigs that pulled the stuff up. It's called flammable pudding. It's flammable. It's kind of explosive. It's a semi-solid. I think the best explanation would be something like dry ice that the Good Humor Man has, only this is four times more potent than carbon dioxide. And it releases when there's subsidence on the ocean floor there. And I was wondering if anybody's bringing this into consideration when they talk about offshore drilling.
All right. Thanks for your call. And before we get a response, I'll just remind you, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Jackie, can you respond?
To be honest, I don't know too much about the use of methane hydrates as fuel, but as I recall, methane hydrates were one of the big challenges during the 2010 oil spill, where the BP rig in the Gulf of Mexico exploded and began gushing oil into the oceans, and there was an all-out effort to try to get to contain it, which, of course, we were unable to do. Very, very disturbing. We all watched it. And when they tried some of the solutions, they were foiled because of these methane hydrates that are down there. So perhaps there's an energy value that I'm not familiar with, but it also brings to mind yet another reason why offshore drilling is something we should be moving away from.
All right. Let's go now to Frank in Little Rock, Arkansas. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate the topic today. I think offshore drilling is extremely unsustainable practice, and that offshore wind is probably marginally sustainable. We really need to be focusing on solar energy. There are thousands of more jobs per megawatt hour of production in solar and, say, onshore wind than there are in all of the fossil fuel technologies combined. So if these states want revenue and they want jobs, they need to be promoting solar installations.
Eric, do you want to comment?
No, it's a great point. We do support an all-the-above approach to energy production. We recognize that we need all sources moving forward, and we're going to need oil for decades to come, which is why, from an energy and national security standpoint, we have to make sure we're exploring in new areas like the Atlantic, as we see Cuba, the Bahamas, and Canada doing. From a renewable side, from 2000 to 2012, the oil and natural gas industry was actually responsible for approximately 17%, or $11 billion, of all investments in non-hydrocarbon resources, including wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass. So this industry takes it very seriously. The primary business we're in is oil and natural gas development, but there are significant investments going on in renewables.
Michael, I gather you are largely opposed to the president's offshore drilling plan. Are you satisfied with his overall action on climate change?
I think the president's record on climate change and the environment has been exceptional, particularly given the obstacles that he's faced with a Congress that is simply entrenched and unwilling to do anything on the topic at all. You know, as he's developed his energy policy, he put out an energy policy in 2014 that had three specific pillars to it: supporting job growth and economic growth, increasing our domestic energy security, and thirdly, deploying low-carbon technology and transitioning to that kind of clean energy infrastructure that the caller's talking about. And solar is really a huge part of that. It has tripled in this country in the past, during the Obama administration. There's three times as much solar as there was initially. And, you know, the policies that he's putting into this offshore drilling program are part of that all-of-the-above strategy that he recognizes. And I think where it's different within the Obama administration from the all-of-the-above strategy that the Republicans talk about is that third pillar of his policy, that transition to a new energy economy, low-carbon technologies, getting us off the addiction to oil that President Bush talked about in his State of the Union, and the unpleasant side effects of that, of clean air pollution, of water pollution, and ultimately of climate change, which is really the bugaboo that we have to be aggressive about in this country.
Michael Conathan of the Center for American Progress. Short break. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full-body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. From Citrix, with GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring HD video conferencing, screen sharing, and meeting recording capabilities. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Fresh Air, the University of Everywhere, how online education may transform college education as we know it, making college affordable and accessible no matter where you live. We talk with Kevin Carey, the author of the new book, The End of College. He directs the education policy program at the New America Foundation. Join us.
Welcome back. As we talk about new plans for opening areas off the U.S. coastline, drilling for oil and natural gas. Here's an email from Taylor in Houston, Texas, who says, the world in coming years will need more natural gas and oil is politically and economically in America's interest if that comes from the U.S. Offshore development creates great high-paying jobs for construction, steel, and all associated development workers. The reactions of many seem to be emotional rather than pragmatic in this debate. Jackie, do you want to respond?
Sure. Offshore drilling isn't the only way to create jobs. And we actually did an analysis. We put out a report called Offshore Energy by the Numbers. We had found that in the Atlantic in the next 20 years, wind could create 90,000 more jobs than what offshore drilling could create. Could just about create double the jobs. And, you know, I would point out, too, that offshore drilling can also be a big job killer if you look at the impacts of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico and a lot of people out of work for a long time down there because of offshore drilling. So I'd rather see us create jobs that are going to last into the future that aren't going to lead to economic and environmental disasters. And by the way, it's more jobs to begin with.
And Eric, here is an email for you. Someone who writes says, I oppose the proposed new drilling rules because I don't believe there will be any way to ensure such drilling can be safely done. What will the new safety requirements be for future drilling so we don't have another Gulf disaster? Can the oil companies guarantee they can handle any future blowouts within a few days?
Well, we have to make sure we have a balanced approach to energy production. We need to harness these benefits, harness these national security benefits that we can obtain, but doing it in a safe and environmentally responsible way. You know, we had an oil spill commission that was appointed by the president. It was chaired by Bill Riley, former EPA administrator, and Senator Bob Graham, former senator from Florida. And they concluded recently, within the last year, that they are pleased with the way the industry and the executive branch have moved ahead on the commission's recommendations to improve the safety of offshore drilling and the capacity to respond to spills. Government and industry are working together to create a safety-conscious culture in the offshore drilling industry, and the industry has substantially improved its capacity to respond to rupturing wells by pre-positioning caps for ready deployment should trouble occur. Thus, offshore drilling is safer than it was four years ago.
Amy?
Well, I think we should remember that there was no law. Congress did not pass any laws in the wake of the BP oil spill. There was lots of efforts to do so, but of course, with this gridlock environment, that didn't happen. That said, there was a lot of reforms at the Interior Department. And just recently, a couple weeks ago, the Interior Department proposed the first ever federal regulation for drilling in the Arctic region, which proposed specific standards that companies must abide by if they're going to drill up there. Now, there's currently no drilling in the Arctic Ocean at the moment. Shell Oil has been the most active in pursuing plans up there. They've already done everything that these regulations really require, but they're quite extensive, much more so than the regulations in the Gulf. And also, there's another regulation coming down the pike in the next couple of months that will require tougher standards for blowout preventers, which was the type of technology that was partly to blame for the BP oil spill.
Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I think the caller asked, can we guarantee there are going to be no spills? Of course, the answer is no. You can't guarantee that. And Amy's point is extremely well taken that Congress has done absolutely nothing in the aftermath of arguably the greatest environmental disaster that we have seen in America's oceans or perhaps any oceans around the world. Zero response. And we can expect that to continue for the foreseeable future. And the regulations that the Obama administration are implementing are good steps, but they don't really address the underlying problem, which will need to be addressed by Congress. And that is ensuring that the oil companies who are reaping the profits from what is a public resource are adequately bearing the risk of those actions. And that's risk in terms of climate change and carbon pollution. It's risk in terms of spill potential. And really, the first way to start doing that is by raising the liability cap. The liability cap for a company operating offshore right now, drilling for oil, still sits at $75 million with an M. And as we all know, BP's liability from the Deepwater Horizon spill was many billions with a big capital B.
Do you want to speak to that, Eric?
Yeah, the liability cap is lifted and doesn't apply if there's negligence or failure to follow a regulation. So generally when you have this type of incident, you have a situation where there might be negligence or a failure to follow a regulation, and the public has borne no expenses related to the Macondo incident. So the system works, and Amy's point that the government, through the Department of Interior, has put significant new regulations in place is an important one, because the government and industry work together hard to enhance prevention, intervention, and response capabilities since this spill.
Jackie, tell me why groups like Oceana are so opposed to drilling in the Arctic and what the experience of Shell has been.
Well, we're very opposed to drilling in the Arctic for a lot of reasons that Michael mentioned earlier, which is it's a very dangerous place to drill. You're talking about a place that is dark for most of the year. It's extremely cold. There's floating ice, very large pieces of floating ice. When there is a problem, the response capabilities are almost nil. So, for example, if you remember during the Gulf of Mexico when that oil spill happened, you know, they were calling in ships from everywhere. Everybody was trying to help. We can't. It's going to be a lot harder to do that in the Arctic, especially if it happens during one of the months that it's cold and icy up there. And you know, Shell has been really very, very persistent in trying to do the exploration drilling in the Chukchi Sea that they've been wanting to do. You know, they're not taking no for an answer from the Arctic, and the Arctic is every time pushing back and saying, you really don't want to drill here. The story that was written in the New York Times Magazine about a month ago just really illustrated so well how hazardous of a place this is, where these people were on the drilling rig Kulik, hoping to save their lives. They almost didn't get out alive. It just doesn't make any sense, and that's just exploration drilling. So we just think it's not a sensible place for us to be drilling. They did put out some new regulations recently, which we think are good to have, but they really do need to go a lot further up there if they want to allow drilling.
Eric, is it worth the risk for drilling in the Arctic?
Absolutely, and when you look at this from a national security perspective, we are sitting back idly while Russia and other countries from around the world are moving forward and advancing technologies and developing these resources. The U.S. should be a leader when it comes to energy development in the offshore and in the Arctic. We have the best engineers. We have great regulators. We have enforcement in place. We have capabilities to undertake these type of projects and apply the most advanced technologies. So the world should be looking to us rather than us sitting back and watching Russia help cement its own energy security and have that lever over countries around them by using energy as its political leverage.
Michael.
Well, I agree with Eric on one point, and that's that the U.S. needs to do more to be in line with Russia in their capacity to operate in Arctic waters. We will have a piece coming out later this week detailing the need for the U.S. to purchase and build new ice-breaking vessels, heavy all-weather ice-breaking vessels. Currently, the United States has one operational heavy icebreaker. It's actually currently limping home from Antarctica, where it just conducted a dramatic ice rescue of a fishing vessel down there, but in the process did quite a bit of damage to some of its engines. So it's headed back into port again, this following about a $50 million retrofit, and this is a vessel that was built in roughly 40 years ago. We have one other that's currently in dry dock with similar engine troubles, and that's it for heavy icebreaking capacity in the U.S. Russia has six nuclear icebreakers, largest in the world.
To Carl in Berlin, Maryland, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane, for taking my call. I'm so impressed with your panel. But ultimately, I always come to the same conclusion, or actually the same question. And as I always wonder, are we ever actually going to change the paradigm for the oil and gas industry as long as there's a drop of oil in the ground that is desirable to the consumer?
Michael.
Well, assuming that the paradigm being that the oil industry is allowed to develop and ultimately not pay for the externalities of its actions, I think we're hoping to make steps in that direction. But really, much of that responsibility is going to fall on Congress, whether it's removing tax breaks for oil companies, whether it's increasing the royalty rate or bonus payments that companies need to make in order to extract the resources that, as I said before, belong to the American people. These are all things that we need to take into account, particularly when you consider the cost of the pollution that comes from the carbon that's produced from drilling and, of course, from consumption. We need to be more realistic about these effects.
Amy.
I also think it's important to recall that in the last 5 years, we've had a complete change in the way the oil and gas industry has been operating and how much oil and gas we're getting. 5 years, five, six, 7 years ago, we thought we were at peak oil, and now we're awash with all of this oil and gas. And so I think as long as we have this abundance of oil and natural gas that is creating jobs and is changing economies around the country, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, I think that is deflating any sort of political urgency to change the paradigm.
You know, it's fascinating. We heard on Morning Edition this morning that in Houston, Texas, the number of jobs that will be lost is really going to be close to 100,000 because the price of oil has gone down so substantially. They're closing down wells and laying off people. Now, considering that fact, considering this low price of oil, why do we need more of it now, Eric?
Because as we look into the future, we know that we're going to need oil and natural gas for decades to come. Our own Department of Energy forecasts that. The International Energy Administration forecasts that. The question becomes, where do we want to produce it? We should do it here. And we should also recognize that the price drop that we've seen has been something to help consumers at the pump all around the country, and it's going to stimulate the economy. And it's helped us in our leverage with countries like Venezuela, Iran, and Russia, who rely upon oil and gas revenues to fund their governance and fund their military. So we are having a huge impact in the U.S. and out.
Here's a question about politics from Jake, who says, given the much greater risk of environmental damage, what possible rationale did the president have for increasing offshore drilling while stalling the Keystone XL expansion? Aside from pure politics, he talks like an environmentalist but doesn't act like one, Amy.
Right. I think depending on the perspective that you come at, you think he can be balanced or he can be political. I think with the Keystone XL pipeline, that issue has become so political over the last 6.5 years that it's completely separated from any sort of substantive policy issue. And now that decision is awaiting, as we're anticipating, a final decision in the coming weeks or months, as President Obama said yesterday, a final decision out of the State Department on that pipeline. Looking at the offshore drilling plan, this five-year blueprint is required by law every 5 years out of whatever administration is in office. I would note that in the last blueprint that governed the lease sales from 2012 to 2017, that final sale had 14 compared to what the one just the other day had 15 proposed. And of course, as I said, it can only become, you can only have less lease sales when in the final product. So I would guess that by the end, it'll be even less than what he did before.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Jackie, I know you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, Diane, I think that it's important to remember that in context of your question about the Keystone XL versus this proposal, that the decision on offshore drilling is not yet made. This is a draft proposed program. There are two more stages where they can only, as Amy says, they can only take things out, and we certainly hope they will. So there's still time for President Obama to make a more consistent call on this, and there's a lot of good reasons to move away from oil, whether it's spills or climate change concerns or because you know there are better solutions that are longer lasting. We hope he will, but I don't think that the president will make the right decision if all the only people he hears from are the oil industry that have obviously a financial interest in getting that last drop of oil, which is why people really need to engage. And Oceana is trying to provide opportunities for people to do that. Department of the Interior is having listening sessions now in many communities on the Atlantic coast, including one in Annapolis coming up next week. So, and we can connect people with those because really it's going to be the voices of the people really the only thing that's going to overpower the voice of the oil industry.
Jackie, do we know actually how many spills have occurred offshore? Who's keeping track?
Well, Diane, actually, there are a number of spills that happen, and I don't have an exact number for you right now, but, you know, they range in size from the regular, constant, chronic leakage of oil, which happens anytime we drill for oil, small drips here and there, which add up to a lot, to the medium size and to the larger spills. We often don't hear about them all the time, and we heard about the BP oil spill, of course, but there are many that occur that we don't hear about. And so this is still a continuing problem, and the safety, the new regulations that have come out from the Department of the Interior over the past few years since the Deepwater Horizon spill, didn't really do a lot to address the problem. And in fact, what they did in many cases was solidify practices that were already being proposed by the petroleum industry, that some of which were already being used on the Deepwater Horizon rig, and obviously they didn't succeed in preventing the spill. And so we were unable to find any real serious substantive requirements that were likely to prevent the next major oil spill.
Michael.
Yeah, and I think to pick up on that point about spills and about concerns, as well as about public involvement, the one thing that I haven't heard said here today is that when oil gets in the water, it doesn't stay in one place. The oil that came out of the Deepwater Horizon, the Macondo well, ended up from Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, all the way to the beaches of Florida. And the oil that would spill offshore from Virginia, North Carolina, because of the Gulf Stream, it's going to go north, and it's going to go to the states where political opposition at a state level as well as at a local level is very strong, consistently against offshore drilling.
Last word, Eric.
Well, one thing I like to point out is the public, by tremendous margins, supports offshore development. On election night, we saw 70% of voters come in support of offshore development, and all along the coast, Virginia 65%, North Carolina 71%, South Carolina 71%, Georgia 77%, and Florida 64%, all supporting expanded offshore development. Polls done by Harris that you can see on our website. So we see tremendous support for this. The country and the public gets it. They know that it creates jobs and gives us energy security.
All right. We'll see where this goes. Eric Melito of the American Petroleum Institute, Jackie Savitz, she's vice president for Oceana, Amy Harder, she's with the Wall Street Journal, Michael Conathan of the Center for American Progress. Thank you all so much.
Thanks, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yerblifter answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts.